Committee on Health and Human Services will come to order. Representative Heintzman moves approval of the minutes for April 10th, 2018. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes from April 10th? Seeing no additions or corrections, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The minutes are approved. We have House File 2996 from Representative Kreisha. I will move House File 2996 be laid over. The bill is before us. There are no amendments. Representative Kreisha, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. The House File 2996 is a child welfare training bill, and this is the training academy that coming out of the governor's task force recommendations. This was one of the pieces that we needed to complete, which is the training component. And so what we are doing with this bill is we are putting together the Minnesota Training Academy, partnering with the University of Minnesota, and in doing that, we also get a matching funds from the federal, so we get a nice 2-for-1 on the dollar. So this is simply putting a training program together for social workers, because right now the need that we have is, realistically, if you were hired as a social worker today and we put you in the field, we won't get training for you for about 6 months, and that's just not a good situation to have. So this expands the child welfare training from DHS and allows counties to have more training available. I'm sorry, I'm just catching my breath, but that's the short and sweet of it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Are there questions for Representative Kreisha on House File 2996? All right. Seeing none, does anyone in the audience want to testify on House File 2996? Seeing none, Representative Kreisha, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. With that, House File 2996 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Representative Kreisha also has House File 4113. I will move House File 4113 be laid over. There is an A1 amendment in the packet. Representative Kreisha, would you like to explain the A1 amendment and the underlying bill, or how they go together, and we'll put it on?
If it's okay, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is just adopt the A1 amendment. This gets the bill in the shape that I would like, and this tightens up a little bit of language on the fiscal side, on fiscal year 19, and where the grant funds go, as well as including pregnant women. And then what I'd like to do is, once this is, if this is adopted, that I would turn it over to my testifier to explain the bill and the amendment together.
All right, Representative Kreisha, all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted to House File 4113 as amended.
I'm sorry. I wanted to make sure I got the pronunciation correct for my testifier. So I have with me Laura LaCroix DeLune, and I would like her to speak to the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and explain the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura LaCroix DeLune. I'm representing the Minnesota Targeted Home Visiting Coalition. And the purpose of this bill is to seek additional resources for home visiting services, targeted home visiting and evidence-based home visiting services, and to change two policy items, which are to make programs available to both evidence-based and targeted programs. Currently, the funding is for evidence-based only programs. The intent to allowing non-evidence-based or non-model programs to have access to these resources is because not all models will serve all families. So specifically, we are interested in being able to serve the homeless and highly mobile community. And with the existing models that are available, we cannot access these resources for these specific families. And then there are other populations that may be impacted by that. And then the final adjustment was to allow both of those programs, ensure 75%, at least 75% of the funds are spent on evidence-based programs, and then allowing for that 25% to go to more emerging programs and innovative programs.
And our other testifiers have just arrived. Do you want?
Oh, they have.
Yes.
And, Mr. Chair, I didn't know if we were going to make it here in time, but it sounds like I have my other testifiers.
All
if
right.
I could bring them up.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm Carolyn Smallwood, CEO of Way to Grow. Thank you for having me here. I'm a little out of breath. I'm coming in from another meeting. And we have a parent with us, Nina Tao. Move your chair up. I'm here today on behalf of Way to Grow and the Minnesota Targeted Home Visiting Coalition. And families that are in need. The coalition seeks stable funding statewide for targeted intensive home visiting services to increase support for home visiting as a core early education service. At Way to Grow, we provide intensive home visiting services to families in the Minneapolis area as well as Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center. We've been around since 1989. The first thing that we believe is that parents are the primary educator of the child. So we provide those early education and child development services. We have to assess the family homes first by connecting them to primary needs such as food, clothing, housing, and medical. And then we get into the child development. We do this culture by culture, language by language. There's seven different languages that are spoken in our organization. So we move into early education, then of course K through third. We start prenatally all the way to grade three. However, with our holistic approach, our home visitors are considered coaches and mentors that work with folks by building deep relationships. On average, our families receive up to four home visits per month. Okay? And that's phenomenal. Our goal is to empower parents so they can be their child's primary teacher in the home. Last year, we did over 11,500 home visits to over 2,400 people. And of those 2,400 people, there were 1,400 children. We know with the new funding, home visiting funding, programs like Way to Grow will have the opportunity to engage more families in the Minneapolis area and throughout the state. And we would like for you to continue looking at new funding in this particular area. We also know that home visiting services far outweighs the resources that are available to support families. We hope that the legislature will continue to invest in families. I would like to say, personally, I really do appreciate the effort that has been put into bringing intensive home visiting services throughout the state of Minnesota. It is well needed. And research indicates if a family obtains the right resources with the right support, they're able to turn their families around. I ask you not to give up on this very innovative strategy. Also, we know that your early investment has had positive lifelong impact. To give an example, last year 94% of our newborns were born healthy because of home visits. 87% of our children were deemed ready for school. 98% of our children in our preschools were deemed ready for school. 100% of our teen parents did not have a repeat pregnancy. So I'm telling you, this work can be done. Now I have in front of me one of our parents that we love dearly, and she's going to tell you her story, Nina Tao. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Tao. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nina Tao, and I am a participant of Way to Grow. I'm a mother of four children, Itachi, who's six, Ian, who's three, Elias, who's one, and Aizen, who would have been four if he was still here, too. I shut myself completely away from my daily lifestyle for 2 weeks. After the loss of my second child, I met my family educator from Way to Grow, who came in my home for a home visit. She helped me cope with my loss and gave me helpful resources. and listened to my story, and I didn't feel alone. Sorry. With my home visitor, I had a connection, and I was able to open up and tell her and ask her for anything and any help that I need. I have lost all hope in life, and or so I feel. I honestly forgot how important my child's education was. Home visiting has been an important resource for me as a parent. Before home visit, my son didn't know all of his alphabet, his colors, and numbers, and he was 4 at that time. And in just a short period of time, from just home visiting, my son was able to name all of his color, his alphabet, and his number. And it has also helped me understand my child's need at a younger age, and that has also helped me become a better parent. I am now more involved in my child's education because of Way to Grow. With education being so important and home visit, my son was ready for kindergarten, which set me to advance my own education. I attended Summit Academy, OIC. It was hard, but I was able to accomplish it. Now I am a certified nursing assistant and a community health worker. I hope that you will continue to support this important resource to help other families like mine thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tao. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've resolved the issue. I don't have a question.
Oh, other questions? Representative Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but I just, you know, when we have testifiers like this, I just hate for us not to respond and let you know that we appreciate you being here, that it's no shame in shedding a few tears here because a lot of people do. And thank you very much for sharing your story with us today. I think home visiting is so incredibly important. I actually think it's one of the best things we do in this state. And I appreciate the bill. I'm very supportive of the bill. And I would like us actually to, if I could just wave a wand and make a choice myself, I would put a lot more of our state money into home visiting because I think it's a very valuable thing to do. And the difference between the what they call evidence-based and the what's the other language you're using here, targeted. I used to be confused about that. It's not, the language isn't real clear about what the differences are, but I do understand that both are really important. So I really appreciate the bill, and I thank both the testifiers for being here today. Very helpful to hear your stories.
Thank you. Well, I brought some tools with me, if you all are interested in some tools, early education tools as well.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on House File 4113? All right. Seeing none, any final questions from members? Seeing none, final word, Representative Kreshev.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And I'll be very brief. I know you have a full agenda, but I just want to say that in other committees, you may have heard me talk about two- and three-generation solutions. And I've been very consistent in what I'm trying to do with child protection and trying to change that side of things. But the child protection system is very responsive. But I know the real meat of the solution happens at this level. And what we need to do is we need to find ways to get resources for these families before they become somebody that's working in the child protection system. Because what happens is, frankly, as our testifier said, we all are going to have trauma in our lives. And some people, that trauma creates conditions that are unthinkable. And they react in ways that we wish they didn't. And we have to react to that. So if we can get ahead of the game and put the skills necessary in, I believe we can start to solve this in the second and third generations.
All right. Thank you, Representative Fischer. With that, House File 4113, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Representative Fischer.
Thank you.
And testifiers. Next up, we have House File 3778, Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 3778, the laid over. There is an A2 author's amendment. I will move the A2 amendment. And Representative Peterson, would you like to just describe the amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the A2 amendment is a result of a lot of collaboration between all stakeholders. And basically, this particular amendment will change the language of the most current recent survey to the survey every, use the 2016 market rate survey, and then provide a survey every 3 years. And it also helps determine the priorities and funding with the federal funding contingency, so it helps define which ones are the most important, for example, those that are homeless.
All right. Thank you. All those in favor of the adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The A2 amendment is adopted. And Representative Peterson, the House File 3778 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So basically, we've heard this in House File 3205 as well as House File 3778, but it was all dependent on the federal funding component. But basically, it's defining the homeless person as according to the federal definition. It addresses families who are receiving MFIT who are already ready to move into a transition year. Can do so as early as 1 month instead of the 3 months, which is currently right now. It lays out the steps for processing applications for homeless families and expedites this to make sure that they get the resources that they need, and also addresses the portability pool changes when families move from one county to another. The homeless families will receive 60 hours of child care assistance per service period for 3 months, and then the rate changes we've already discussed, and those are also in the bill, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Would you like to go to testifiers?
Certainly.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Remnant. I'm the CEO of People Serving People, and we're the region's largest shelter for children and families experiencing homelessness. And I recognize that we have a very full agenda, so I promise I'll be very brief. In 2017, People Serving People sheltered nearly 2,000 children and their families. The average age of a child in our shelter is 6 years old. In addition to providing meals and shelter, People Serving also provides supportive services for families. We have a four-star parent aware rated program at the shelter and in our Center of Excellence in the Phillips neighborhood. We're a proud member of the Kids Can't Wait Child Care Coalition, and we thank Representative Peterson for her commitment and hard work to improving child care assistance programs and making them work better for families and providers alike. We strongly support the provisions of this bill that eliminate the barriers to consistent care and family economic security by maintaining CCAP through the portability pool when families move between Minnesota counties, and more quickly transitioning families from MFIP to transition year child care. Additionally, this bill creates much greater stability for families experiencing homelessness, which is something that we obviously wholeheartedly support. Every day we see the struggles that families experiencing homelessness face and the cycles that keep them homelessness. Unfortunately, 90% of the mothers that we serve that are experiencing homelessness are survivors of sexual and or domestic violence. And homelessness in itself is a traumatic experience for children and in these families. Because of the trauma, chaos, and instability, it is often difficult for families experiencing homelessness to secure housing, employment, and child care all at the same time. This bill can make a difference in the lives of children and families experiencing homelessness. Families come to us in chaos, looking for stability, their worldly possessions in a few large suitcases. They may not have the paperwork with them that they may need, and they may need additional supports while they look for employment. During this time, having child care allows kids to be in a structured learning environment and also allows parents to look for work and get the documents in order that they need. This is an important point for us. If we don't take the expedited applications and 90-day verifications and waiver of work requirements together, we're setting up these families to fail. They're simply unlikely to have everything with them and ready to go when they apply for CCAP. The provisions of this bill will do that and create the needed a new approach to truly help these vulnerable families make the experience of homelessness brief and non-reoccurring. This is something that we all, a value that we all share. We also know that many providers are accepting CCAP families into the programs at a financial loss. updating the provider reimbursement rate is critical to ensuring that providers can afford to serve CCAP families. While this bill takes a step forward in addressing the gap by tying the rate to the 2016 Child Care Market Rate Survey, to be in compliance with federal requirements and to ensure that the reimbursement rate doesn't erode year after year, we need to tie the rate to the most current market survey. This important policy change would require funding supplemental to the federal funding using this bill and an investment from the state. We do understand that this bill's approach keeps the proposal budget neutral. However, as the session progresses and we move towards final budget negotiations, we encourage you to build a state investment into this funding. Many provisions of this bill can help the state's most vulnerable children make real gains and close the achievement gap and set them up for future success. Their parents would have peace of mind that their children are receiving high-quality care while they keep and seek employment to support their families. This two-generational approach also contributes to the reduction of the looming workforce shortage that helps our families break the cycle of homelessness. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on House File 3778? Seeing none, member questions for 3778. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just don't see a fiscal note here. Do we have one?
Mr. Byrd?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, there is a pending fiscal note that did not get done in time. We just had this amendment yesterday afternoon. There's a subsequent issue with the effective date that we have to clarify, so we will have one shortly. I can tell you from estimates from the agency that the state administrative cost on this is going to be in the range of between $200,000 and $300,000 a year. The anticipated that the rest of this will be covered by federal funding that was approved in the federal 19 budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other member questions? Seeing none, final word, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for your consideration.
All right. Thank you for your bill. With that, House File 3778, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Next up, House File 3251, Representative Zerwas. Representative Zerwas moves House File 3251 be laid over. There are no amendments to 3251. Representative, the bill is before us. I understand you have some testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House File 3251 is the Home and Community-Based Services Innovation Pool. The Innovation Pool is a source of competitive grant funding that we originally passed in 2015 to provide disability services, advocacy organizations, and individuals with disabilities themselves an opportunity to take proactive role in shifting the disability services system by increasing competitive, integrated employment, community living, and inclusion. The fund spurs innovation by investing in projects and initiatives which demonstrate results in cost savings and measurable outcomes in these subject areas. Additionally, grant funding available through the Innovation Pool offers opportunities for providers, advocates, and people with disabilities statewide to participate in efforts that shift the system at the individual and system levels, sharing and using their own expertise to drive change, increase cost effectiveness, and improve service. Last legislative session, we approved one-time appropriation of $1 million, and that small investment within the $2 billion system of HCBS is really showing some gains, and I'm really proud of the work that the Innovation Pool has created. It's important to ensure that sufficient resources are available for this project continuing into the future. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have some testifiers who are available to provide a brief testimony in lieu of today's heavy agenda.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alicia Munson. I'm the Public Policy Director with the ARC Minnesota, a statewide nonprofit advocacy organization that works to promote and protect the human rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, actively supporting them and their families in a lifetime of full inclusion and participation in their communities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 3251, which seeks to maintain current funding levels for the Home and Community-Based Services Innovation Pool that funds projects and initiatives which specifically help people with disabilities achieve competitive, integrated employment, independent living, and meaningful inclusion in their communities. As you know, funding from the HCBS Innovation Pool is divided into three parts: large grants that fund proposals over $50,000, small grants that fund proposals from $2,000 to $50,000, and micro grants that are awarded directly to people with disabilities to achieve individual outcomes. In your packet, you'll find a one-page overview of these various grants and a list of the projects being implemented by current large grant recipients, including the ARC Minnesota. Last session, as Representative Zerwas mentioned, the legislature approved a temporary $1 million funding increase in 2018 and 2019, and by maintaining the current level of funding as proposed in House File 3251, we hope more projects and initiatives like those you'll hear about today will continue turning the ship of disability services toward greater independence and inclusion. I'm joined by my colleague Susan Zohaki, Marketing Specialist for the Minnesota Microgrant Partnership, who will highlight ways in which the ARC Minnesota has put opportunities for innovation into action, demonstrating that meaningful change at both the systems and individual levels can sometimes be accomplished through small, strategic investments, such as those available thanks to the Innovation Pool funding. We are grateful to Representative Zerwas and Bill co-authors Halverson, Albright, Thacker, and Lunin, as well as members of this committee as a whole, for your bipartisan support for investments in the HCBS Innovation Pool over the past several years, and ask for your continued support today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Munson. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Zohaki. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Dean and members. My name is Susan Zohaki, and as Alicia said, I'm the Marketing and Outreach Specialist for the Minnesota Microgrant Partnership. The program launched late last year thanks to funds made available through the Home and Community-Based Services Innovation Pool. With this funding, the partnership has made grants averaging $850 to Minnesotans with disabilities who have financial barriers to achieving goals which are important to them and for them, their goals related to employment, housing, and community inclusion. Since the application process opened, over 125 people from counties throughout the state have applied for funding, which has the potential to change their lives. Grantees are selected by a review panel, which includes service provider staff, community members, advocates, and individuals with disabilities. We've heard some astounding stories from grantees about how this modest investment in their lives has helped them to obtain employment at or above minimum wage, housing that is safe and accessible, and fuller inclusion in their communities. For many, these funds have been catalysts for increased well-being, skill development, and opportunity to contribute to their communities, resulting in increased confidence, independence, and income. One individual who really exemplifies the exponential change that these grants can provide in a person's lives is Joshua Schultz. He's the founder and owner of Schultz's Lawn and Snow Care Service. As you'll note in your packet, Josh received a microgrant through the HCBS Innovation Pool in December and used the funds as a capital investment to bolster his business. I'd like to read the following statement from Josh regarding how the small infusion of cash impacted his life and his business prospects. Starting my business after working in maintenance for the past 10 years has been so awesome. I finally feel like I'm doing what I love and that I was meant to be my own boss. What I'm most excited about my company is the personal service I'm providing. Other lawn and snow removal businesses are so big, I want personal value to be what I do best. The gift of new equipment is going to help with light snow blowing and the cleanup after mowing in a much quicker fashion and do a much better job for my customers. Josh's service facilitator, Jody Iverson of LifeWork Services, said that seeing Josh's transformation from being a job hopper to a business owner has been a highlight of her 30-year career in this field. She notes that since starting his own small business with help from the Innovation Pool, Josh has demonstrated skills in marketing and networking and has learned the importance of budgeting and saving. With your support of House File 3251, other people with disabilities will have the same opportunity to experience satisfaction, pride, and meaning like Josh has. The Innovation Pool funds really have afforded him a lot of opportunity, and we appreciate your continued support. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Lockhart.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that the microgrant examples are the kind of thing that really empowers individuals to take charge of their life and start planning and achieving their dreams. And I think that's the whole goal of the Olmsted Plan and our movement towards person-centered approaches. I'm a little concerned about the larger grants and whether or not those are really person-centered and individualized, as opposed to, it sounds at least from the descriptions, that mostly it's an organization creating another program that they process large groups of people through, which is, I think, kind of the opposite of person-centered, but it might be just the way someone wrote up the short descriptions. And so if I could get some follow-up information on what are the sizes of the grants, you've got some examples. You've got the current grantees, but you don't have the amount of money for each grantee. Some are going to serve large groups of people. Some are pretty small, and some seem like they're being paid to do what we've always asked them to do, which is help people achieve meaningful employment. And so I'd just like to get a better understanding of the larger grants and how they differ from our regular funding of those operations, and whether or not, if they're pilot projects, what do we have for learning transfer? So if one of these is trying some innovative approaches and they wanted to test it out with this funding as an innovative approach, what's the plan to roll that out to others so it becomes part of our normal approach without us having to reinvent the wheel 100 times through 100 different grants?
And Mr. Chair, members, I can be sure that we get that information over to Representative Loeffler and the rest of the committee.
That'd be great. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Other questions for Representative Zerwas or Ms. Munson? Seeing none, final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
All right. House File 3251 is laid over. Next up, Representative Albright brings House File 3860. Representative Albright moves House File 3860 be laid over. The bill is before us. There is an A1 amendment. Representative Albright to 3860 and the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the amendment, after discussions with the Minnesota Board on Aging, we determined it was best to focus the goal of this legislation on senior companions as it relates to tracking health care cost reductions. So we've struck the foster grandparent program for now. And we also do not intend the funding to be one-time in nature, and we've added that to the base.
All right. All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it's no secret that we have a significant age wave approaching and coming ashore. The growing population of seniors overwhelmingly want to live in their own homes for as long as possible. That's better for seniors, it's better for our community, it's better for health care costs. The Senior Companion Service is a cost-effective way to help keep people in their own homes. Senior companions are seniors themselves. They are stipend volunteers who provide transportation to doctor appointments, errands, social support, and more, benefiting both the senior volunteer and the senior being served. In 2017, 402 senior companions served over 2,200 of their fellow seniors, providing over 222,000 hours of service, and driving over 1.4 million miles in Minnesota. Youth and Social Services has already piloted some promising health care partnerships that are yielding results that we can expect will continue over time. With me to talk about promising strategies with senior companions is Roxanne Jenkins from LSS Services of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, good afternoon. My name is Roxanne Jenkins, and I'm the Associate Vice President of Older Adult Services for Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. I'd like to thank Representative Albright for bringing this bill forward, and thanks to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee for the important work you do and for the opportunity to testify today. For over 150 years, LSS has been providing services to people with disabilities, older adults, children, family, and youth. More than 2,300 LSS employees and over 8,000 volunteers provide services in 300 communities and to all 87 counties in the state of Minnesota. Today I'm here to speak to you about companion services. Who are our clients? Our clients are older adults, most of whom live alone, oftentimes have low income, are at risk of not being able to remain living independently without additional assistance or resources. Their family and friends have moved away or have passed away, and they're adults who don't have anyone to call for assistance or support. Our companions provide weekly friendly visits and companionship. They also increase the social connectedness for isolated older adults. They provide rides to doctor's appointments, grocery store, pharmacy, and affinity activities. And through this, they help reconnect people to community, to their congregations, to their affinity groups. They also help identify questions and health concerns and help write them down for the persons that they're supporting so they can bring those to their doctor or their care provider. How is companion services funded? There's federal funding that comes from the Corporation for National and Community Services in the amount of $584,186 in this last fiscal year. Currently, the state of Minnesota, through the Minnesota Board on Aging, provides $570,087. We also partner with healthcare entities and currently contract with two hospitals slash clinics to provide senior companions to persons who are frequent visitors of their emergency departments. We've included our latest report on those healthcare partnerships in your information packet. This report shows that once a companion is paired with an adult who is a frequent visitor, their visits either stop or drastically reduce, mitigating costs to the healthcare system. We're still working on developing more evaluation to these outcomes. LSS also contracts with volunteer stations or other community-based organizations who help with the recruitment, the training, and the supervision of these volunteers, and LSS provides the reporting and administration. The proposal today will impact healthcare partnership and how that works. As part of our senior companion services that I've described, we currently work in partnership with hospitals and healthcare systems to identify persons who are frequent visitors of the emergency department and in some cases readmission to hospital. Volunteer companions are matched with these individuals to help adults to best manage their care with new strategies. So they help ensure regular scheduled visits to their primary care physicians are made and kept. They provide rides to those appointments, but also for grocery store and pharmacy. They capture those integral questions regarding their health or prescription to share with their physician or their pharmacist. They even attend appointments if they're requested. The hospital and LSS are sharing outcomes data, such as emergency department visits and the reduction in those visits. We also provide depression screening pre-companion, and then again at 6 months, and again at 1 year. We're also tracking some readmission hospital data, but we're building the process for that. We have seen significant improvement in all of these cases. This last year, 19 senior companions served 49 persons who went from 40 emergency department visits down to 18, which represents a 55% drop in emergency department visits in 1 year. We've identified the need in this partnership for a more robust evaluation process to best capture the impact of our services with regards to those individuals served, the volunteer, the healthcare system, and to project the savings from these reductions in hospitalizations. To accomplish the healthcare partnership model, we have worked very closely with the Corporation for National and Community Service and the Minnesota Board on Aging to design the service. We are one of the first senior companion providers in the nation to be targeting our efforts to high-end users of healthcare and for tracking that data. We've modeled this option with two hospitals/clinics and have seen promising results. We believe now is the time to expand this model of service further through state support to individuals who are more likely to be high utilizers of healthcare services. The proposal before you today would do the following. It would allow us to recruit an additional 50 new volunteers, provide an additional service for 200 adults, targeting individuals who are identified as high utilizers of healthcare services, and potentially eliminating some of our waiting lists for service. To expand the healthcare partnership outreach contracts and continue to improve service to reduce unnecessary healthcare costs, such as overuse of emergency department and readmission to hospital. These volunteers would provide an estimated increase of 39,000 additional hours of direct service to seniors in their homes, support the development of a more robust evaluation process to quantify the cost savings in healthcare of companion services, and establish a method to utilize a return on investment model. We have enjoyed a long partnership with the Corporation for National and Community Services and the Minnesota Board on Aging, and we would design this project in partnership with them. We see this as a wise investment in our communities and for older adults. They're growing by population daily. Helping to support our Minnesota neighbors to stay healthy and at home in a way that is dignified, person-centered, benefits both the givers and receivers through companion services. And it's a smart way to help reduce health care costs. Thank you again for this opportunity. I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Jenkins. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on House File 3860? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Jenkins. I can see where for a lot of people living in their own home in the communities, this is really a vital service and a vital check-in. I just wanted to know, since you're talking about in the future targeting high-end users of healthcare, and the handout that you give us is an example of someone who's already living in assisted living, I would hope that your priority would be people who are actually living in their own independent home as opposed to people who are already spending $2,000 or more dollars a month for those kind of support services where they're living. And could you tell us a little bit about how you decide when to go into assisted living clients versus people who are in their own homes?
Ms. Jenkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that's a very good question. Thank you for asking. The example that we gave was, we thought it would be a good story to share, of someone who actually served as a volunteer companion for 20 years and turned around and was able to utilize the service herself. Most of our clients are not in assisted livings, and those who are high-end utilizers of healthcare are primarily living in independent settings. Either they're single-family homes or oftentimes in apartments. They're more isolated. Assisted living clearly has other supports in place. This is just that's a rare example of one of our clientele. We work closely with healthcare to be able to find those particular persons that are high-end utilizers. We also would be looking for people to self-report that they are frequently visiting emergency departments.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Seeing none, Representative Albright, final word.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to share the story with the members.
All right. With that, House File 3860 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Albright. Next up, we have House File 118. Representative Howe.
Chairs are empty, so you're okay.
It's been sitting around.
I can see that.
All right. Representative Howell, welcome to the committee. I'll move House File 118 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. We have the bill before us. Representative Howell, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 118, what it does is takes the federal income guidelines and resource guidelines and applies it, basically an asset test, to those that receive food stamps, or more commonly now known as SNAP. I will say some folks will characterize this as a way to kick people off of the program. That in no way is the intent of this bill. Those in need should get assistance. What this bill does is it tries to prohibit those with considerable assets from receiving the assistance that they should not receive. So it's actually setting up some guidelines to protect the program from abuse. I will say that, you know, you will hear from folks that have opposed this that the guidelines are too low. The limits are too low. I am open to another limit. Provide a limit that is satisfactory to you. I am open to that. The federal guidelines actually limit to one vehicle. We have exempted that. We took that out. So it does not limit the household to one vehicle. So members, some folks will say this doesn't happen. I've got my testifier here who is my constituent, Rob Undersander, who will explain to you how this program is being abused.
Thank you, Representative Howell. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Undersander, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Rob Undersander from White Park, Minnesota. I'm here because I think the state of Minnesota should not give food stamps to millionaires and high net worth individuals. I know you do because my wife and I have received nearly $6,000 of SNAP benefits over a 19-month period ending in January of this year. Why did we do this? To raise public awareness. In a nutshell, we would not be here talking today if we hadn't. sitting here for the last hour listening to all these other individuals and programs in need, to me, this is even more wrong, I guess, appalling. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program should be made available only to those in need, not people like my wife and myself. Why are we eligible? Because eligibility in Minnesota is based on income only, not assets. If one has money, one does not need money from the government for food. As most of you know, the food stamp program started in 64 under the LBJ administration, underwent a major overhaul in the 2008 Farm Bill. In addition to changing the name to SNAP, retirement savings and education accounts were eliminated from asset testing eligibility requirements. Many states, 35 to date, took that as a sign and eliminated asset testing altogether. Our relatively expensive house with its high mortgage payment, taxes, and insurance qualifies us for a higher benefit because those benefits are based on net income. We received up to $341 per month. I've personally talked to several seniors in the St. Cloud area who are struggling financially and only received the minimum $15. Asset testing with excess value determination would have prevented this disparity. Also, I would like to see retirement accounts included in tested resources. Our Roth IRAs have enabled us to live very comfortably without counting as income. Growing up in a small dairy farm, I was taught to work, save money for retirement and rainy days, and live off those savings later in life. But because Minnesota does not count those savings, I'm allowed to siphon unneeded welfare benefits. Representative Howe told me that some of you are concerned about the initial cost of asset testing. I spoke to Jan Goligowski, the Stearns County director responsible for administering SNAP benefits, and she confirmed that, yes, it would indeed take more time to verify every asset on every application. My recommendation is one that allows us to have our cake and eat it too. Just as every tax return is not audited, not every SNAP application would have to undergo asset verification. Applicants, like tax filers, could be subject to severe penalties for falsifying information. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this point, if anyone has questions.
Well, Mr. Undersenator, I just had, Representative Pinto, go ahead.
Oh, no, that was for you, Mr. Chair.
Curious, so you're just here as a private citizen, you're not with an advocacy group on any...
That is correct.
Okay. And so you are somebody who qualifies for this benefit, you don't want it, and you think that it shouldn't be available to people like you because you don't need it, and you see by just the limited time you've been here that there are people who truly do need that help.
Absolutely, yes, sir.
Well, thank you for being here today. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just trying to understand your... I apologize for prying, but I guess it's for asking a personal question, but I guess it relates to the account you provided. Your gross income then is less than the federal poverty guidelines, the 165% that is the current requirement under the SNAP program for you and your wife.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes, sir. Again, part of the reason is, of course, when you have savings account, Roth IRAs, as you know, that does not count as income. So we didn't need a lot of income. We're able to basically control our income. My wife took her Social Security benefit, but that is about equal to our house payment. So that's why it works that way, because they look at, and I believe, and that's correct, by the way, that's the right way to do it. They look at your total income and then what your basic expenses are. So does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, do we have a sense as to what that gross income level is, the 165% of federal poverty guidelines that is the current requirement for SNAP? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I understand what you're asking, Representative Pinto. I think what the testifier is saying is that you can have cash and assets and you don't need income, and many people do if you sell a business or if you have cash. That doesn't show up on a K-1 or W-2 or or 1099.
And Mr. Chair, I guess what I was hearing is it sounded like there's some income that the testifier received and maybe others as well that is not being counted right now. And so I guess I wonder if maybe for Representative Fowle, maybe another way of dealing with this is just to make sure that folks' income is fully being counted. It sounds like the testifier has some income that was not being counted, and so therefore he maybe wouldn't have been eligible for SNAP benefits if his full income was being accounted for. Because it does seem like taking into account the money that's coming in for folks, as we do currently, in general, I think most people would make sense. So I'm just trying to understand that.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pinto, the problem is under the federal SNAP guidelines is that if Mr. Undersander was required to take his Social Security before drawing SNAP, he wouldn't qualify. His income would be too high. But he was eligible. He deferred his Social Security. He drew on his IRA. IRA doesn't count federally under the SNAP guidelines. Now, I don't know if I can go ahead and count it state. If we can do it just by state guidelines, we can do that. I don't know that. I thought I'd be trampling on federal law, so I didn't go there. But I know we can apply an asset test. So that's the only area that I believe that we can affect that. So I think, and I've been talking to the congressional delegation to change the federal guidelines to actually require if you're eligible for Social Security, that you should draw your Social Security before drawing food stamps. I'm also talking to them about if you have an IRA and you're taking a draw on your IRA, that should count when you're looking at SNAP guidelines. So I'm talking to the congressional delegation to change that federally, because I don't know if I can change, I don't believe that I can change that statewide and enforce something more restrictive than the federal guidelines on the income and how you associate what is income and what is not.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, the point I guess what I'm getting to is the expression bad facts make bad law. We have a testifier who has, by his own admission, he and his wife are fairly well off. He's chosen to, he took this path and was receiving SNAP benefits. Sounds like technically that he was entitled to receive. I'm not sure that an individual and his wife who did that in order to sort of make this point is necessarily saying that this is in fact a widespread concern, especially given the responses that I think we're about to hear from all kinds of folks saying that this is going to be burdensome on the not only on the people involved, who are people that in general are really difficult circumstances, unlike our testifier. I guess I have those concerns. And I guess my last question is just, is there a fiscal note or some sense as to how much it'll cost the state to have this kind of to add this additional test that then is being evaluated?
Mr. Berg, has there been a fiscal submitted on this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, there is not a current request on that. I think there was some concern that there would need to be some modifications. As far as costs, I don't know. The state SNAP is a federal program and it's federally funded. So really changes to this program will not affect the state budget.
Okay. I just want to recognize that we do this sort of thing, Mr. Chair. There certainly is a cost, not only for the individuals involved, but in general, the vast majority of whom are really hungry. That's why we're providing this benefit, but also cost on the rest of us as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You knew this was wrong, and you did it anyway. And frankly, I find this pretty despicable.
What?
The guy has far more money probably by his own admission than is legally allowed to have, but he found a loophole. I'm actually just sorry there's no way we can prosecute you, to be honest. The vast majority of the people here are on this program need it. And you highlighted a loophole on this program. And yes, the people that do this kind of thing should be prosecuted. We should find a way to find out about their assets. But you said you collected some $6,000? Is that correct?
Yes.
So you were on it for a while before you decided to highlight it?
No. Mr. Chair, may I address that?
Please do.
I understand your concern, and to be honest, I anticipated some reaction like that. this is not a loophole. This is law that, as I was trying to explain, and the tide has changed in Health and Human Services in the last 15 years, where there's an effort to help people get back on their feet very, very quickly. And so the thought was that if they they didn't want to deter them from having savings accounts. I think the converse might be true. I think if people know that if they make bad financial decisions, they have a safety net. And as soon as I took these benefits for this purpose and started acting on it right away, we tried last year to do something. And I also want to point out, I understand your reaction, Representative Considine. I also want to point out that every penny that we've collected, we've given to charities, my church, and needy individuals. And I feel that my wife and I can do a better job of distributing these benefits than the federal government can.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Considine.
Thank you. I am pleased to hear that you gave the money to the church. That would certainly be better than your keeping them. But again, this is not a typical case for people that are on SNAP, and I don't like seeing it being portrayed as such. Thank you.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Constantine, the county actually went out and did an audit, fully compliant. That's the problem. I think it's our responsibility. It's the legislature's responsibility to put those guidelines in place to make sure those that are in need are getting it, and those that aren't, don't. And I think that's our responsibility to put those guidelines in place to ensure that those that don't need it and have considerable assets cannot get the benefit.
May I respond to that?
Representative Considine, if you wish.
Thank you. I agree with Mr. Howell on that.
We have a limited time, and I know you didn't. I know, Representative Considine, you didn't mean to intimate that the testifier was in some way breaking the law, which I think somebody could construe your comments to mean, and I think it should go on the record that you did not intend to say that. Is that correct, Representative Considine?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think if somebody takes benefits that they're not entitled to, they should be prosecuted. Now, I think if Mr. Howell said that indicated that the audit indicated that he did not break the law.
Thank you, Representative Pasadena. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, so I understand under ERISA that qualified retirement plans, whether they be a defined benefit, defined contribution, an IRA, ESOP, those type of things, those are protected from sometimes the scoring for these types of benefits. My first question goes to, I have to remind myself, is there any difference based upon, say, when the required minimum distribution age hits? Are those required distributions then considered as part of the scoring for income eligibility, or are they still excluded?
Mr. Chair, and it's Representative
Albright.
I'm not an accountant, my wife is, but my understanding is that the answer to your question is no. The minimum required distribution, I don't believe, would have any effect on it. It's simply, are they coming from a Roth IRA, which the taxes already paid, so that doesn't count as income. A traditional IRA, I'm withdrawing from that now, by the way, and that is income, which does disqualify me from SNAP benefits. But also, you could have a savings account in a bank, you know, and that those taxes are paid, and that doesn't count.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe going to the line of questioning in terms of your initial eligibility, but there's nothing that would preclude you from taking benefits because the law stipulates that you don't need to include assets other than what is in the law for consideration. That's correct, is it not?
Yes, sir.
And so it's not illegal to do what you did, other than to suggest that there is a point in the program where it becomes a bit want for correction because of what you stated in your initial comments. You don't need it, and so you're pointing out the flaw in where that threshold is for people. I don't know that I heard you suggest that we're trying to intimate anyone from not having availability to benefits, but there is a gradient in terms of where people probably need it more than others, particularly if they have hard assets or assets in retirement plans that should be considered as being available for income on a yearly basis. Would that be a correct statement?
Mr. Understander.
Yes, sir, I do agree with that.
Thank you.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I wrestle with is, as I'm hearing this here, is
there's concern in terms of the assets, et cetera. And the thing that I wrestle with is that over the years in the jobs that I've had, is it's not unusual that with the guidelines that we have right here, people who are supposed to get SNAP or should be eligible for them don't get them in the current situation. Because even though it says proof of income, many times when they go for proof of income, there's several things that come in, is that they've applied at a temporary agency. If the temporary agency or the businesses that they applied to don't fill out the forms and get the forms back to the county, they end up getting denied their services and support until somebody can chase down to the business to get proof that the person is no longer working there or is working below a certain threshold. There's also the issues of victims of identity theft. It's not unusual to some of the populations that we work with because that they're lower income, they're people of color. It's not unusual that they get preyed on in identity theft and because of the populations that they're in. The likelihood of getting it reported, of it being reported, is much lower, and those things being fleshed out. So things start showing up as income that they might have or assets that they have that they really don't. And these are some of the concerns that I have as you're coming forward with the program, and it bothers me a little bit because, you know, the people that I see and work with on a regular basis are by and large very poor people of color who should be able to get access, and are having the biggest trouble getting access. And then we have a situation where somebody doing very well off seems to be able to get the money without much of a problem. And that's where I'm struggling with right now, is because some who really need it aren't able to get it because of denials in the process. So I'm bothered by the way it's being approached.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know Representative Pinto asked about a fiscal note. Representative, how have you requested a local impact statement to find out what your bill, impact your bill would have on counties and local governments?
Representative Howe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huddleston, no, I have not, but I would hope that the Associated Minnesota Counties will provide me that information.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
And to the testifier, did you, on the months that you drew this benefit, spend more than $278 on food for you and your family?
Mr. Understander.
Yes, ma'am, we did.
Okay. I think it's important to know that people in the SNAP program very often have very little disposable income to spend beyond their $278 a month. Have you always been able to provide food for your family?
Mr. Understander.
Yes, we have.
Mr. Chair, I think that it's really important for you to also know what it feels like for families who can't provide food for their children. These are families who are working. I think that what you have brought us is a piece of a narrative. You have drawn a conclusion that somehow SNAP benefits are being abused. Do you have any evidence that SNAP benefits are being abused in your community?
Representative Halverson, I think the testimony goes to the fact that he qualifies for something that he shouldn't qualify for by his own admission. I don't think he's... he's here to testify on that. Representative Halverson, you know, what do you hope to accomplish by that line of questioning?
Mr. Chair, I think it's important. The testifier has brought us a very clear proposal, very clear solutions for a problem that he has yet to define actually exists. We don't know that there is an epidemic of people taking benefits for food that do not qualify for it. We know that this testifier took $6,000 worth of benefits that he did not qualify for.
Representative Halverson, I believe that he did qualify for it, and that's the problem.
He did not need it. I'm sorry. We need to, when I say qualify, I mean people who are in need. You know if you're hungry and you can't feed your children. You know if you are not going to make it till the end of the month. And so if you've taken the $6,000 of benefit that and you were not in need and you were able to supplement not only the money that you got from the federal government but with additional money and then you admitted that you didn't need it,
You did so in order to draw a conclusion about every other person in the SNAP program, and that is where I find a real concern.
Representative Halverson, I think it's just as likely that you could say that there are people who do not qualify but are hungry and do need food, and that those in, who are truly in need are being displaced by others who are receiving benefits who do not. It is perplexing to many that there is such strident opposition to anything that looks as though it makes it, we are looking harder at qualifications for benefits or determination of eligibility for benefits. And the strident opposition and personal attacks on people that bring that up are very perplexing to many.
Mr. Chair, I am perplexed at the fact that we are discussing a solution to a problem that we have yet to establish actually exists. If there were data, if there were information about people who were taking this benefit and who were not in need. Now, I have heard anecdotal stories all of my life about people who think that their neighbor maybe isn't in need or somebody isn't in need. We don't know. We can't know by looking at somebody what their need is. We can't know by somebody's employment status what their need is, because we know that a lot of people who are in need of assistance temporarily at different times of their lives are most often employed. And so the fact that I'm perplexed by the fact that we are not talking about this issue of hunger in Minnesota, which we know exists, which we know has been growing, not because we've been spending more on the program, but because more people in all of our communities are hungry. The percentage of children in my community that are hungry, and I live in an affluent community, have been rising. And so to come to the legislature and to make assumptions about people who are using SNAP benefits in the state of Minnesota, and to make assumptions that they are somehow that they are taking benefits that they do not need, is a real stretch from this particular testifier's experience. I think that you can create all kinds of scenarios, but this is nothing more than one more attempt to say that people who are accessing public programs in Minnesota are not working hard and are not qualified and are not in need. We're not addressing what the actual issue is, and that's why I'm finding this incredibly offensive, that $6,000 of benefits were taken on a program that, and I hope somebody addresses this, currently can't meet the need. Our food shelves, my food shelf in my district that serves thousands of people, can't meet the need. SNAP can't meet the need. My church that delivers meals to children in my community can't meet the need. And so I am perplexed and offended by a narrative that says that somehow this person's experience can be extrapolated to every single person in the SNAP program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Halverson, in no way does this bill or this attempt try to signify that people on SNAP aren't in need. All this is an attempt to do is put the guidelines out there, and help me, if you're concerned about that, help me correct and put the right guidelines in here to make sure those that don't need it don't get it, and those that are in need do get it. This, I don't want to take anything away from those that need it. This in no way is an attempt to do that. What this is an attempt to do is to put some guidelines out there and some curves, some structure to it, that those with considerable assets aren't receiving what they shouldn't get. And right now, there are no guidelines. It's wide open. And that's all this is trying to do, is structure it so people like Mr. Undersander with considerable assets cannot get to this program. And that's all we're trying to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was inappropriate to apply for these benefits to make this point when you can make this point without doing that. You can make an argument and bring a bill forward without committing something that you didn't need, knowing you didn't need it, taking $6,000 away from others who do need it. And I don't. Who are those people, Representative Howe? Those people that are taking it that don't need it. That's the data that Representative Halverson is asking for. Which individuals are getting it that don't need it and have other assets and wealth? We don't know that that's even occurring. So I think there's been over 60,000 people already that have been kicked off SNAP because of other eligibility that need it, and that's why we see an increase of families that are going hungry and children. So I think the witness should have never applied for that benefit. We expect people to do the right thing and to behave accordingly without having to create new state laws and mandates to act accordingly, and if they didn't need it, don't apply for the benefit.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Undersander.
Representative Schultz, I'd like to respond to that. I understand what you're saying. Lost my train of thought. When I learned about this, I'm a volunteer health insurance program advisor for Senior Linkage and have formal training, and I learned about a number of these programs. And I was appalled. I'm learning about the asset requirements for medical assistance, for federal Medicare savings programs, and we get to this program and there's no asset test. Now, I could have, to answer your concern, I have done research on SNAP asset eligibility laws, and I could have talked to my friends and said, hey, I've been doing some research, and here's what I found out about SNAP asset, and their eyes would have started glazing over. Yeah, that's just human nature. But if I say I'm a high net worth individual receiving food stamps, I have their attention, and it's obviously gotten your attention. I really don't think I would be here if I hadn't audited the program, so to speak. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, Mr. Undersender, I'm really sorry about the line of questioning that has been being put forth and the accusations. And Representative Howe, I applaud you for taking the concerns of your constituents seriously, for representing him. He came to you with what he sees as an issue, and you took the time to listen to him and take his concerns seriously. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're about here, right? So you have Representative Howe as your state representative, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so you went to him and asked for a meeting. You said, Representative, this is an issue. I would like you to represent me because that's what you're elected to do. Could you bring forward a bill? Am I on the right line of thinking here? And I'm assuming that Representative Howell, being the awesome legislator that he is, had a bill drafted. He sent that bill over to you. You took a gander at it and said, yeah, this is exactly what I'm looking for, or maybe here's a tweak there, a tweak here. But at the end of the day, he drafted that bill for you. And Mr. Undersander, you're actually very lucky because we have a lot of bills that we draft up for our constituents that don't get heard, okay? I have a few right now that aren't going to get heard this year. Hopefully next year that those issues will be able to come to light. But sometimes our bills are not heard at all. So this is pretty lucky that you're actually here in front of this committee, so that's great. And also, had Mr. Undersander not applied and said for the benefits, right, and had said, I think this is what's happening, but he had no proof, he'd come before, the line of questioning would say, well, how do you know? You're just making things up. You didn't even apply. You're just assuming. So you went forth, you brought forth and got the data, and you said, here, Mr. Howe, Representative Howe, here's what I did. Here's what I found, and this is a problem. And I I am sure, Mr. Understander, you want to protect the integrity of the programs, and you want to make sure those programs are there for people that actually do need the help. And you're saying, people like me, we don't need the help. Okay, you were being honest, coming forward, and laying everything out on the line, and now being accused of possibly, you know, you should be in jail, and you're a criminal, and how dare you take these programs that are meant for people who need them. Well, if the programs are there, and there is no asset limit and no guidelines, people are going to take that. That's just, some people just have that in them. That's their human behavior. We would like to think not, but at the end of the day, if there is some cookies laying out and it says free, maybe you don't need a cookie in your life, right? But it's a free cookie, so I'm going to take that cookie. That's the same thing with public programs. If they qualify for those programs, why not take them in some people's line of thinking? So I'm sorry, Mr. Understander, that you are being treated this way. You should be able to come to this committee, any committee, without being accused of being a criminal or being a thief. And Representative Powell, thank you for representing your constituent.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair and Representative Powell and to the testifier, first of all, this obviously is a very emotion-fraught conversation for a lot of people. I think, Representative Powell, part of the problem is that you did actually start out in your presentation by saying, I believe it was you and not the testifier who said something about, this is about how the program is being abused. Now, I understand what you really hear about, what the testifiers really hear about, is whether we need to tighten up, whether we need to have an asset test. It's not about whether the program is being abused. So I have to say that there's a difference there. And I think we can talk logically and rationally about whether we need to tighten up some eligibility requirement. That's a very different conversation than whether the program is being abused, which you have brought to us one example of. Okay, so I just want to set that as a groundwork. One of the problems today for us in hearing this bill is that we don't have a fiscal note. And I think people have to step back for a second and think, why do we have asset tests, and why do some programs have no asset tests? Why have the asset tests been removed? I believe the reason is because sometimes the bureaucracy around figuring out who deserves or who doesn't can be more costly than the cost of making a mistake and including some people who may not need the program. So without having any kind of fiscal note, it's really pretty hard to evaluate whether it would be a good idea to have some kind of asset test in Minnesota for these benefits, right? We can't evaluate that. A lot of times in this committee, we hear about all the bureaucracy it takes for government to do some, if we're going to sit and sort through look at everybody closely and go out and say, how much is that car worth and how much do you really have in that bank account? Even if it's on a sample basis, you have to hire people, you have to have systems to do that, and those things cost money. So we need to evaluate that if we're going to take this seriously at all. So part of the concern I have, I understand the bill is going to be sent to the Reform Committee, which is, I thought was more or less done for the year. But, okay, I don't know. To hear this bill in this Finance Committee without any kind of fiscal note, it's hard for me to understand the point of that, because you really can't make a real rational decision on it without that information in front of you. So there's that. The thing, though, I want to respond to one more thing. Well, a couple more statements I want to make. One is I understand why members are a little upset about the fact that I'm not upset about the fact that you applied for the benefit to see if you could get on it even with your assets. Okay, I get that. But you stayed on it for 6 months. I don't know why it took 6 months to prove the point, and then that you took the money, and then you made the statement to us that you could make a better decision about who needs it than the federal government can. Well, I don't know how you check, you know. I mean, people say that, and, I mean, it's easy to say. It's really easy to say that is all I want to say about that. But finally, I just want to address what was just said by another member about if people qualify, why not just take it? That people, there's this idea out there that people just want free stuff. And what you have to understand is that a lot of people who are in poverty feel a lot of shame about that. We're talking the people that are generally on these programs, and I didn't come here today with data on this, but I bet you a lot of people in the room could bear this out, that people are more likely not to apply for a benefit that they actually could get and actually do need because they feel shame about that. People who are poor don't want to be poor. People feel shame about having working off and they're working really hard and they can't make enough money to really support their families. So we have to look at this holistically, and that's, I think, why a lot of us get very emotional about it, because when we think about these programs, we're thinking about the people. You know what? I just got a message from somebody in my community who told me she's a grandmother. She's raising two grandchildren. She was writing to me about having gotten her tax return garnished. But she was telling me a little bit about, you know, her situation and how she lives. And she has a college degree, and she's working two jobs. And she and the grandchildren are still in deep, deep poverty. That's the sort of thing, like about half of Minnesotans are actually really struggling hard just to get by, just basic living. And then we spend committee time with this bill, which, and I'm not accusing you, I don't share the feeling of some of my colleagues here, I'm not, you know, yelling at you for doing this at all, you know. It's a legitimate concern. But here we are using committee time, very valuable, scarce committee time, where we have real big, serious issues in the state about those kind of people who are barely getting by. And we're hearing this bill without even the basic tools to know whether the concern you're bringing us is even is really valid to even solve, because we don't even have the fiscal note. So that's not your fault. But, you know, maybe, I don't know, Mr. Chair, are we going to, if this bill is going to go anywhere, are we going to actually get a fiscal note so that we can evaluate whether this is something we ought to change?
Well, Representative Liebling, I think the that will be in process. The bill will move forward. We'll see where it goes from there. However, I think it is one of the very few bills that have been brought forward by members, frankly, of either side that actually looks at overspending. In ways that we can be more efficient and we can redirect the benefits to the people who are truly in need. And we need to look at eligibility requirements. As you know, we used to have asset requirements for MinnesotaCare. We had asset requirements for lots of programs that we currently now don't do. We had testimony yesterday from the department that it's just too expensive and too hard to collect tens of millions of dollars that the DHS should have that could, frankly, be spent helping people. Those are very strong concerns that I think are very relevant to this committee. And so I thank Representative Howe for bringing that forward.
So, Mr. Chair, you know, on that note, I mean, the very question is whether this saves any money. That is the question.
I think there's a question of whether it wastes money as well.
Well, and we can't know. We cannot know because, you know, for every one person who might be doing what this gentleman did, who's taking it because they can and they don't really need to, even though he's doing it to prove a point, I get that. You know, for every person who might be doing that, there might be lots and lots who are not even accessing the program because they may not know if they would qualify and they don't want to try. But, you know, Mr. Chair, if we're talking about saving money and checking to make sure that people need stuff, I got to go back to the $800 million that this legislature has spent on subsidizing insurance companies. And we're giving them the money without any check for whether they need it. And apparently they've done very well in this last year and don't need it. So, you know, I know you want to put together a bill that has some savings in it, But, you know, unless there's a fiscal note on this, I frankly, you know, I don't know why we couldn't have had a fiscal note by this point in the session. We've had quite a while, and this bill is number 118, which means it's been out there a good long time. Thank you.
Fair point, Representative Liebling. Representative Considine, quickly, and then we're going to finish up with Representative Albright, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howell, I just want to say I do trust you, and I do believe that you are trying to make things better. And if there is something that we or I can help you do to make this better, I think there are some things. I think probably the asset limits are a little low. But, yeah, I do believe that your heart is in the right place. And I think we can... I'd be happy to try to help you with it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howell, as I look at your bill, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're really trying to do is you're not changing, per se, the threshold for where the state would step in and provide benefits. What you're actually doing is reintroducing United States Code Title VII, Section 2014. That really puts an asset test to it for purposes of verifying, to your testifiers, you know, an example of folks that may have means that's excluded otherwise. They still get, from what I read, the benefit at a higher or an elevated level than what would be under the federal parameters. And so to suggest that we're limiting or taking away a benefit from those that are in dire need or are just scraping by, I don't think that that could be anything but further than from the truth. But to the extent that, you know, we speak in hyperbole in committee, I would say that if you wanted to continue to give a benefit to the rich, then don't do this bill. But if you want to, in a sense, hold people accountable for what they've done in life and work hard, save, and then provide for yourself when you retire, then to the example of $800 million to insurance companies, then you should vote for this because it takes something away from the rich that right now might be available.
Okay.
End of story.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's important since we're a finance committee to remember that this is a total 100% federally paid program. So if there's any savings, it's not going to be to the budget that we're going to be wrestling with over the next couple of weeks. If anything, there would be additional costs because the counties do eligibility and the additional time that they would have to make in getting and reviewing records is, I don't believe, fully covered by the federal government. So I think that if we're going to ask for a fiscal note, we should ask for a local impact note as well because that's what the real cost will be within the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Jessica Webster. We have very, very limited time, so if we could please keep testimony very brief, we'd appreciate it. That we'll go through all the testifiers that we can get to, and then we will recess and be back this evening. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and I had a good conversation with Representative Howell last session about this millionaire constituent who was accessing food support. And I did express at that time that I do think there are better and more targeted ways to address this issue and this millionaire who has accessed food. What I think you will represent, Chair Dean, what you mentioned is the strident opposition you'll hear today, and I think what that strident opposition is what this bill does is go from no asset limit to a $2,000 or a $3,000 asset limit. And I hope that we can all recognize what the difference is between a constituent with $1 million asset limit and a senior with $15,000 that needs to make that $15,000 last for the next 20 years for home repairs, and we heard Representative Albright's bill about senior companionship and transportation and long-term care. I think an asset, you know, may look different when you really think about what it needs to be used for. Just to give you a little bit more context on food support and asset limits, food support is a federal program, and Minnesota is one of 35 states that no longer has an asset limit, and that has happened in the last decade because the federal government encouraged states not to have asset limits because they discouraged low-income people from saving money, and they discouraged seniors from accessing food, and they introduced tremendous complexity to the application and renewal process, a process that is, when you introduce an asset test, it introduces errors and it introduces extraordinary county burden. I won't talk much about that because I think the counties are here to tell you what that looks like. So I want others to be able to testify. I'll just say I think there's a more targeted way to do this. I don't think a $2,000 or $3,000 asset limit is probably what Mr. Undersander would suggest when he has $1 million. It's a the way that bill is written is very punitive, and I just hope that we can take a closer look at that. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair? I will say, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will say that when we had that conversation, I invited her to come back with a number to help me work on getting an asset level that would be somewhere in a level, and this is the first time I've seen her since. So,
all right. Next up, we have Peter Wytok, community organizer with Hunger Solutions. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Peter Wytok, organizer with Hunger Solutions Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. So Minnesota at one point lagged behind other states, and I know this was mentioned before, but we're now one of 35 states that eliminated that SNAP asset limit. And so around the same time, Minnesota also moved to a one-page senior application. So we're in favor of simplification. Adding an asset limit is really taking a step backward. Makes it more difficult for people to apply and for counties to administer, as was mentioned earlier. So seniors and working poor are mostly going to be affected by this legislation. We don't want to limit their ability to access the program when a temporary setback, like an illness or job loss, means they have to go deplete their savings in order to put food on the table. And so having access, a little bit of savings helps buffer households against unexpected expenses like a home repair or health care bill. And they're really an administrative burden for many counties. So for these reasons, we urge you to not support this bill because we're not in favor of taking food off the table for many seniors and working poor in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wytok. Next up, we have Claire Grattan from Food Security Program Coordinator, Jewish Family and Children's Services. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chairman Dean, committee members, my name is Claire Graven, and I'm the Food Security Coordinator for Jewish Family and Children's Service. Our agency served 13,000 individuals and households last year, including aging services, career services, mental health services, family and children home visit programs. And I'm also here to speak for our partner agency, PRISM, which is a food shelf in Golden Valley that serves the north and western suburbs of the Twin Cities. Both of our agencies conduct significant SNAP outreach, eligibility screening, and support. Our experience has been with having in-depth conversations about financial eligibility for SNAP, and our finding is that the asset test will not only result in thousands of vulnerable Minnesotans losing access to food benefits, but also that it will cost the state and local government more in the long term. I also want to put my comments in a context, which is in anticipation of this conversation today, I tried to do some research on the average amount of assets that older adults have. And what I found was one data point from the National Institute for Retirement Security, which said that for, and this is for all adults nationwide, age 55 to 64, the median amount of assets per household is $14,000. And so to Representative Liebling's point, I do believe that there is an important fiscal note to be made here, which is what is the average amount of assets people are bringing with them to retirement. And we're hearing from economists at the Humphrey Institute and elsewhere that there is a looming crisis as these adults are approaching retirement without sufficient assets. And so the people that we see at Jewish Family and Children's Service of Minneapolis and at PRISM are the older adults who are facing financial difficulties. And I want to comment on two situations that I see in particular in the work that I do doing SNAP outreach to older people. One is that SNAP, along with mobile food shelves and Meals on Wheels, helps seniors stay in their homes longer. And many seniors are slowly drawing down their assets in an attempt to remain independent as long as possible. So this action of forcing asset limits is going to move people into poverty status faster and force them to become dependent sooner on a broader range of government programs. The other situation that I see, to Representative Liebling's point, are the multi-generational households that I see coming into PRISM Food Shelf, where you have grandparents, adult children, and grandchildren all in one household applying for SNAP benefits. And you see, for example, older adults who aren't yet retirement age who are negatively impacted by the recession and have never been able to get back on their feet again. And so they're working multiple low-wage jobs. They may have an adult child in the household who is also struggling financially along with supporting grandchildren. And collectively, they are still below 165% of federal poverty. They may have some assets that they're using to sustain the household, but what they're doing is drawing down those assets to keep themselves going so that the assets that their grandparents may have thought they were going to have available for their retirement are being spent to keep the family going right now. And I see those people all the time in the PRISM Food Shelf where I do intake on a weekly basis. So very, very quickly, what I want to say to you.
Ma'am, we are over time actually already.
All right.
So
what I want to say is.
We have three more testifiers and we are over time and there's another committee coming in at 3 o'clock. So I would like to move.
This is a humanitarian issue and a financial issue.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Tracy Fishman from Prepare and Prosper. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. I will skip over much of my testimony. You also should have a copy with you. I am the Executive Director of Prepare and Prosper, and as I said, I appreciate the opportunity to testify against House File 118, a dangerous bill to reinstate asset limits on SNAP for Minnesotans. Real quickly, and by way of background, Prepare and Prosper is an organization that facilitates financial stability and well-being through the provision of free tax assistance and access to financial services and products, coaching, and systems change work. We are very focused on the problems of financial instability. One in three families in the United States reports having no savings, according to Pew Research. About half of American families are financially insecure, and a growing number of households experience income volatility with spikes and dips as much as 25% in any given month and even any given week. What's more, far too many families are one financial shock away from crisis. A car breakdown, a medical emergency, or a job loss can be a major setback for a family. So those asset limits that would be in place could severely damage a household if people had to spend down what limited assets they might have. So this affects not only families, but our communities and our economy. So given these economic dynamics and a great deal of research in this area, we have great concerns about this harmful bill that would discourage savings and runs counter to good policy that should foster and not prevent sufficiency and stability. The bill would penalize savings, as you've heard, and ownership, and create more hardship for vulnerable populations. Minnesota has wisely been one of 35 states, as you heard, that that eliminated SNAP asset limits in the past decade, and for good reason. Reduced asset limits have been shown to stabilize households' financial security while also decreasing administrative costs when fewer people cycle on and off the program. We see firsthand how challenging it can be to navigate asset limits. Many of the people we work with face trade-offs in their lives on a daily basis, prioritizing the timing on payment of bills and housing, putting food on the table, supporting opportunities for their children's future development, and more. We have heard many, many stories of people who have shared both their financial goals and aspirations, but then they've had to make hard choices about not saving based on concerns they will lose essential benefits. This is perverse. These choices are too often driven by policies that have harmful consequences for families in our communities. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity, and I urge you to vote no on House File 118.
Thank you, members. We do have to clear the room, so we will be in recess. We will come back this evening at approximately 7:30 after caucus at the call of the chair. So stay tuned. We will try to get more information. So we are in recess.